Well, hello out there in podcast land, and welcome back to Guilty Pleasures, the show where we celebrate the movies we love despite what critics, public opinion, or even our own God-given sense might tell us. I'm your host, Lou Hare, for the Front Row Network, and welcome to our second MonsterCast episode for Guilty Pleasures for the month of October, celebrating all things horror and spooky. And as you're hearing this, there's still a day until Halloween, so we're going to get one in under the wire, and we have a doozy for you tonight.
Ooh, buddy.
I'm very happy about this movie for many reasons. First of all, we're releasing this on the 30th, we are getting the release of Stephen King's Dr. Sleep, which is a continuation of the Shining universe. So we're going to do a Stephen King movie, which is perfect because we're getting into Halloween. But I'm also extremely excited to do this movie because this is yet another one of our listener requests. This came to us from Justin, who gave us a very nice review on iTunes. We thank you for that, Justin. And because of that, you recommended the movie we're doing tonight, 1985's Silver Bullet.
Woo! That was my wolf impression.
Was that your wolf? Okay.
That was my Gary Busey.
Yeah, I was about to say.
It could be either one. It could be a Gary Busey
line.
Or a wolf.
Yes. So joining me to talk about this tonight, first off, the editor-in-chief of the Front Row Network and our guide through all things MonsterCast, Mr. Jeremy Gechner. How's it going, Jeremy?
Hey, man, I feel like I've just been nonstop recording this month. And you know what? I'm okay with it. I am okay with it because horror films rule. Everyone who says different, you guys suck. You don't. I'm sorry.
Preach.
Coming in hot. Next thing you're going to say, they're not cinema. I don't know. What would we?
Oh, man, no. Who would be stupid enough to say something like that?
Oh, who would call an entire genre not cinema? Anyway, oh, gosh, I'm sorry. I'm having flashbacks from our Slack chat. Anyway.
Yeah. Like every 4 days.
Yeah. But rounding out the panel tonight, we have our flashbacks host, a horror aficionado himself, and the winner of the Stephen King adaptation draft for Pop Culture Draft Night.
Yeah, buddy.
Mr. Ryan Lutens, congratulations, Ryan. Your prize is you get to come on Guilty Pleasures and watch and talk about Silver Bullet.
Well, I'd hope so. I would hope so, because on my list was Stephen King's Silver Bullet. I'd like to think that that's the movie that won it for me, so.
I would really yeah. hope so.
Uh-huh. That movie, yeah, it put you over the top. And if anything would put you over the top, it would be this movie. So before we get into the movie today, I know we do have one little piece of business that we want to throw out to you. And because we're very excited at the Front Row, we got something really cool. If you haven't been listening to the podcast recently, we've got a very cool event coming up that Jeremy's going to tell us all about. What's going on, Jeremy?
Yes, thank you, Lou. Well, here coming up on November, let me make sure I get the date right, November 8th, here in Springfield, we are going to be celebrating our 500th episode of the podcast, which, man, oh man, guys, think of all the things we could have been doing, you know, like, you know, while we're sitting here doing film criticism. No, we are so insanely excited about this. We are going to be doing a live show at Anvil and Forge in downtown Springfield. They will be sponsoring the event as well. But we are going to be doing two separate things at 8 o'clock. We're going to be doing kind of a Front Row retrospective. We're going to bring up some guests, some people that have been very influential in helping us get the Front Row off the ground, and some prominent people from our past. And then at 9 p.m., the pièce de résistance, because Mr. Lou Hare himself will be there to guide us through the bracket, the best of the decade, because we are, of course, leaving the O-10s behind. And we have already been winnowing it down on Facebook, down to 32. If you have not voted, is voting still open for any of those, Lou?
Voting will actually be closed as of this time because we got to get the bracket ready, and we'll put it up so you can see what the final 32 is.
There you go.
You know, and if you missed it, well, shame on you for not being on our Facebook page.
For real,
so
though, right?
Go to the Front Row Network and join the page so the next time we do a bracket, you can be part of it. But the best part is if you come to Anvil and Forge, you're going to be the ones who get to vote on it. The rest of us, our panel is just going to sit there and impotently yell at one another, which is kind of what we do best.
That's the best part is that you guys get to decide. You guys get to help us decide who moves on in the best of the decade. And there are some brutal matchups. I think this is probably your most sinister bracket yet.
It is. And there's already some first round matchups I'm deeply upset about. And by the time we talk about them, I'll probably have a few drinks in me. So who knows what's going to happen?
This is going to be off the charts.
I may get arrested in Springfield because I'm mad about my movies not getting advances, which is, good reason to get arrested.
Yeah, well, I mean, the last time you were here, you stole Lincoln's hat, right, from the museum here? So, yeah. Oh, right. Oh.
Allegedly.
I mean, that was, somebody else.
Look, you try to recreate National Treasure once or twice, and people get make a thing out of it. It's fine. It's fine.
You got caught in the oxygen deprived vault, man. That's impressive how you got out of there. Anything aside, join us at Anvil and Forge 8:00 November 8th to celebrate our 500th episode and to help us determine the best movie of the decade.
Well, a movie that was not the best of its decade is what we're going to be talking about tonight.
How dare you, sir?
I mean,
I think that's a bit of a stretch.
It could be. I don't know. But certainly by most metrics, it would not be considered. But I'm very glad that we're talking about this. But why are we talking about Silver Bullet here on Guilty Pleasures, aside from the fact that it was requested to us? Well, as I mentioned, this movie comes out in 1985. This is like peak, Stephen King movie madness. Cujo had come out and Christine, and we're right in where you just couldn't get enough Stephen King IP out into the masses. And so here's another one in the midst. This comes out the year after Firestarter, and I think this is the year before Maximum Overdrive, if I'm getting my chronology correct. It doesn't do quite as well as some of those other Stephen King movies. It makes $12 million off of a $7 million budget. So on the good side, it's profitable, but it's still nowhere near, by any stretch of the imagination, a success. What I'm surprised by is its Rotten Tomatoes score is actually kind of higher than I thought it was going to be. It's at 47%.
Wow.
And so, that's almost prestige level for Guilty Pleasures. at an IMDb score of 6.4. So
that's too high, man.
Yeah. I'd go for a 5.
Okay. So for those of you who don't know what Silver Bullet is about, when a young boy discovers that his town is being terrorized by a werewolf, it's up to him and his sister and his drunk uncle to stop it.
That's pretty much, that's good.
That sums it up. and a half of that.
That's about, yep. Mm-hmm. It stars Corey Haim, Gary Busey, and Everett McGill. It's directed by Dan Attias. Dan is not a film director per se. This is his only film credit. He mostly does a lot of TV. He does a lot of prestige TV, by the way. He's directed a lot of episodes of The Wire. He does a lot of stuff for HBO. He has some Entourage credits. It's Always Sunny, 90210. So he becomes a very prolific TV director, but not so much with the movies. But there might be a reason for that, and I'm gonna save that for a little bit later. The writer of it is the man himself. It's Stephen King. It is a screenplay by Stephen King, loosely based on on his short story Cycle of the Werewolf. So this is, again, this is screenwriter Stephen King phase, which is also mid-80s, which by his own admission is
cocaine,
That hardly ever goes well.
Yes, this is cocaine era Stephen King. does that show. So
no, it feels like it's written by somebody on cocaine.
it certainly does. So, okay, so let's turn it over to first impressions. How familiar were either of you with Silver Bullet prior to seeing this movie? Let's start with Ryan.
For me, I, as a kid loving horror, I always tried to, just get a glance of what Stephen King had written. And I remember Cycle of the Werewolf because it had pictures. And because it had pictures, I would just kind of look at the pictures, maybe read a few words. Then I heard it was a movie. I'm like, okay, this is right up my alley. So first impression was, is, hey, this is a werewolf movie. So, you know, I didn't see it until the 90s. I want to say 96. So I was like 11 years old. But I remember first watching it on TV, and I had said to my mom, who made me grow up and love horror, I was like, I want to see this. So we went to the Blockbuster, got it on VHS, and I watched it. I'm like, man, this is a good movie. Growing up, I realized that my 11-year-old mind is different from my, you know, mind now. I'm like, okay, there's room for improvement, but it's still okay. It's an okay movie. But yeah, so that was my first impression.
All right, Jeremy, how about you?
You know, I remember my dad watching this on cable a few times. And what's funny to me is, like, watching it back now, like, the level of violence is kind of high for, you know, like a mid to late 90s cable watch.
Was it TNT that always showed it?
I'm pretty sure it was, because I mean, like AMC shows it now, and you know, like, that's fine. AMC can show whatever the hell they want. But so yeah, I remember watching, and it was always, for some reason, I always remember the ending. Like, I never remember anything else. I remember watching Corey Haim do his, you know, badass wheelchair motorcycle, and then watching the end, and that's pretty much all I could ever remember until you know, watched it for this. And man, you know, it's a tough needle to thread to do werewolves and sociopolitical, you know, impressions of the handicapped in America, and tax dollars in municipalities. I mean, King is going all over the place here, man.
While throwing in some very pointed commentary about the church and church leaders, which we'll get into as well.
I'm telling you, man, watching this again was surreal, man. I wrote down so many notes.
Well, good. We will get to every last one of them, but I had not seen this movie until this podcast. So I want to thank Justin for exposing me to this movie, because I mean, I vaguely remember a movie called Silver Bullet, another Stephen King movie. You know, my horror experience as it growing up was more of the Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween variety. So the Stephen King train, I kind of missed me by a lot. So, so I hadn't seen a lot. I've seen some of the, like, the big name Stephen King movies, but not, some of these, I guess, we'll call them deeper cuts maybe.
No, that's fair.
And I'm glad, but I'm very glad that I did, because I gotta say, I had a blast watching this movie.
Yes.
So much fun.
This movie tells you exactly what it's going to be in the first 5 minutes with that very first kill.
Yeah.
Train.
Yeah. No, because I think you put it out, Jimmy, you're right. This movie, like, this is, you know, I know it's a punchline, but it bears out. This does feel like a movie that was written by someone on cocaine, because there are so many different thoughts and things and ideas that just, like, shift wildly as you go through it.
Yeah.
And things that don't really add up, but probably, like, if I heard, like, Stephen King pitching this to me while he was on coke, I'd be like, oh, that's great. Cause it's like, it's a movie where, like, where werewolves stalk you.
Yeah.
And that's where we're starting. Like, a werewolf, like, werewolves, if I know my werewolf lore, and you two, please correct me, as the horror experts, I'll defer to you. Werewolves aren't necessarily known for, like, their prowling, right?
They're more like, get you, rip out your throat. Kind
right.
Of
they're these wild, untamed beasts. And so we're already departing from that, from like the first frame of this film.
No. You got to think T-Rex is not velociraptors here, man. I mean, they're just going after it.
Right. But in this movie, it's like, it's clear that, like, they were almost, because it is the 80s and, you know, Friday the 13th was such a big, you know, the slasher genre was so big. They, like, wanted to make a slasher movie where the slasher just happened to be a werewolf.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, because the werewolf has, you're right, like a lot of sentience. It climbs houses, you know, and it has apparently it has religious motivations.
Yeah. Yes, right, it specifically targets people. I've never seen a werewolf like this. Normally it's like, oh, the full moon's out, here comes the werewolf, he's gonna just start attacking for no reason because he's a werewolf. Yeah. And not this,
thing
one.
This thing has an astounding level of sentience. But you even talked about it though, like the tone, even before that first kill, it's, what is this intro music that we get to this movie? It feels like an 80s after school special. Like it's like major keyed. And I mean, like, I know I'm the music guy, but it's just like, this feels like on Golden Pond's opening music. Like it's really weird.
See, that's what I think. Like he's trying to convey the innocence of Corey Haim's character. And he's really trying to make it, you know, about a kid, but no, it's a werewolf movie where a werewolf is committing murder.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's the weird thing. Yeah, because this movie is from 1985, but it's set in 1976. So in like their effort to make it feel like a nostalgia piece, I agree with you, Jeremy. It does feel, what I felt like, this felt like one of those movies you'd like randomly find on like ABC on a Sunday afternoon in the early 80s. Like that, just like the color palettes and like the just kind of the way that it's all shot, which makes sense. This guy's a TV director, you know, because it looks very much like a made for TV movie. And with only a $7 million budget, it shows in a lot of ways.
No, I mean, it's just so weird because you have this juxtaposition. You've got this, like, you know, you're watching a movie called Silver Bullet that's about a werewolf. All right. And then they give you like this dark image, like at the very beginning. And all of a sudden you hear like the bum, ba da bum, ba, like, and I was like, okay, that's weird, but maybe, okay, it's the 80s. And then a dude gets his head ripped off, like grotesquely. And I was like, what is our tone? What are we doing here?
Okay. Industrialism is bad.
In a way where, and that's the other part where I knew I was like in for a treat with this movie. Because this movie makes every effort to hide the werewolf as much as it possibly can. And we'll explain why in a little bit. I do have some research on that.
Yes. But,
so we see just this claw swipe across the screen.
Yeah.
And then the head just kind of falls off.
Lops off.
And it's like, oh boy.
That's a powerful swing.
Yeah. Like the precision, again, werewolves typically not known for their like precise striking abilities. And here it comes. It's like
their whole forearm strength.
Yeah, man. He caught that right at the base of the neck. But I do have to call out though that the actor there, James Gammon, one of my favorites of all time because of a little movie called Major League.
He's great. Although I got to say, no facial hair. James Gammon was weird. Was off.
Weird. Very weird. Yeah, I didn't like it. Didn't like it at all.
No, but yeah. So yeah, that was where I first was like, okay, we're in for a treat. And this movie delivers on lots of different areas. So let's start off with some favorite scenes, and I think that's gonna get us around to a lot of different areas. So to set up, just to go a little bit deeper into the plot so we can set up these scenes. So eventually, a werewolf, as we mentioned, is kind of randomly killing people off. The town doesn't know what's happening. Mm. Corey Haim figures it out, which we'll talk about, I'm sure. And then we later on learn, spoiler alert, that the big reveal is that the town preacher is the werewolf. And so then they end up having to kill him with the help of Gary Busey. So that's going to get us around from different places.
You Ryan, people better be sold by now, man.
Yeah, like I mean this. Yeah. Okay, so Ryan, let's start off. What's one of your favorite scenes from Silver Bullet?
Okay, so are we going for most ridiculous or most comical?
Whatever strikes your heart, man.
I'm going to go with most ridiculous because it's probably one of my favorite scenes. And then hopefully somebody mentions the comical. So my favorite scene in this movie is just based on the ridiculousness of it. But our murderous werewolf priest has a nightmare. And in said nightmare, he is eulogizing over the latest victims. and all of a sudden everybody in the crowd starts turning into werewolves. So much so that the organist turns into a werewolf. Oh. And the organist, man, she is playing the hell out of that organ, man. As a werewolf. And of course he wakes up, it's all a dream because he is in fact the werewolf, and it's just a projection of his inner conflict about how bad he feels. You know, he doesn't really feel. I did air quotes there.
Is that what's happening?
No, that's what I'm wondering. It's Stephen King on cocaine, so you don't really know.
He feels so bad, he immediately tries to murder an 8-year-old.
Yeah, I appreciate you trying to give some sort of context to that scene. Because
I said, because
I'm glad, because I knew that scene was coming up, so I'm glad we went to the, we revealed the ending first so we could talk about,
Let's just go right into it.
Okay, so... Yeah, you have that scene and it's like midway through and all these people are dying and the priest the whole time has been like, no, we need to not, you know, we, no town vigilant, you know, vigilante.
Stay strong,
justice.
Community.
Right. Stay strong. You know, don't, you know, stoop to their level or whatever. And he has this nightmare after like several people die in another scene. I cannot wait to talk about.
Oh my God. Yes.
But that's what's baffling about it. So, the priest has a nightmare where everyone around him is turning into a werewolf, which makes sense until you realize he's the werewolf. Why is he so scared of everyone else turning into a werewolf? Is it like he's just so guilty that he's like, oh, but
he's not though. That's the thing. It's like we figure out later that he's doing it on purpose. And like, so A, we're already departing from the werewolf mythology where like, you don't know what you've done, you know, like if you go back to Lon Chaney and all of that, you know, he wakes up with no memory. Hell, even Benicio del Toro was good enough to get that one right. And like, but you're right. Like this scene is so weird because it also made me doubt whether the hunting party happened.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Because like, all of a sudden, like he wakes up and like, you know,
was that a dream too?
Because it was the dream scene because, you know, the dad is there, Brady's dad. And I was like, wait, didn't I just see his like head on a spike or something? And so like, it was weird to me, but then like the movie never quite revisits those deaths.
No.
So it's very strange to me.
They're still on the swamp.
No. Like, yeah.
So I was really wondering like why this scene exists in the first place. And I think it's only because you can get just to get that werewolf organist shot.
Right.
Sure.
Thank God.
Right. And that's that's the other thing. This is a movie. This is supposed to be a werewolf movie that also wants it to be like a mystery movie.
Yeah.
Like it wants you guessing like, and again, I could just see Stephen King in a pitch room where he's like, okay, so we got this werewolf. It's going around kicking, but you're not going to know who the werewolf is. And it's going to be, and then he's there. Then this priest is going to have a dream. That's going to be all these werewolves. But guess what? The priest is the werewolf. Everyone's going to be like,
you know, you should go with Stephen King on cocaine for Halloween, Lou.
That was pretty good. And I'm sure all the executives in the room were just like, here's your trick, man.
Right. They're like, well,
here you go.
The killer car movie made a lot of money. I mean, what do we know?
No, that's like, okay, if we give you $7 million, will you leave?
No, that's exactly what it is. It's the Wachowski paradigm.
Yes.
Where no one knew what the hell the Matrix was. So that everybody passed on it. Then it makes $1 billion. So they give them all the money in the world to do whatever cockamamie movie they want. Uh-huh. And then you get Jupiter Ascending. Exactly. And that's what happened because like in the early 80s, you have, you know, you've got The Shining, you've got Christine, you've got Cujo, you've got all those great early 80s movies. And so they really are just like giving this dude carte blanche and like at the worst, probably the worst moment of his life to be given free reign over something.
Literally the least opportune moment of all time. No, but that you're right. But like the scene like takes all of a sudden the action out of it because you're right. Like even though we're dealing with a werewolf, like the action is pretty grounded for the most part, you know, like it does feel like a slasher film.
I just snorted a little at the word grounded. Carry on, good sir.
Yes. Well, no, but I mean, like, it does feel like a slasher movie, you know, like we're getting shadowed kills, you know, and we're getting, you know, like a bunch of quick cuts and everything. They're keeping the supernatural at a minimum. And then here's this scene of literally you know, 50 werewolves emerging in a church, turning into a weird rave of sorts. And it's like, what the hell is this?
Right.
Right.
So my thing is, you know, this whole scene, you actually have some pretty good werewolf transformation.
Yeah, actually.
It's very interesting. And then, you know, you see the actual werewolf in the end. You're like, you spent all that money on that scene?
Yeah, you blew all the money there.
Oh, they literally did, because that is the one time that the werewolf effects look good.
Oh, yeah.
The rest of the time, like, it is a bear suit.
Now you know why we got swinging arm.
Yeah, that's how, like, it is a glorified bear suit with, like, the chintziest, like, you know, helmet on him. And then at the end, they're like, oh, well, it's a werewolf movie. We got to do a transformation close-ups, we got to do that. And like, this is like 2 years after Thriller, and this is like this is the most Aldi brand Thriller I've ever seen. The hair like is very slowly coming out, and it's like, oh, this is
the D-transformation did it that way too. I was like,
I love his face up, guys. The D-transformation, it's just like, meh.
Yeah. No, the whole
thing. So somebody saw Thriller and said, let's not do this.
Right. Well, they're like, let's do this, but with less money.
We don't have
always
this
well.
Money.
Yeah. We apparently don't have MTV money. We are a major motion picture studios, and we cannot get as much money as a 8-minute music video.
Yeah, and I gotta say here though, like, what's your guys' read on Everett McGill in this movie?
Because, oh my
God. I mean, not to derail the favorite seas, but this guy, I got so many questions.
I'll defer to Ryan because I got nothing right now.
Everett McGill, People Under the Stairs.
Yes. Perfect. No, perfect.
Everett McGill, Silver Bullet. What?
Yes. No, because here's my issue. Do they say where this takes place?
No.
So I'm going to assume, like every other Stephen King story, it's in the upper Northeast.
It, yes.
Why is there like a Southern, like Confederate preacher in this town?
Well, there's so many Southern accents in this movie. They mentioned the movie takes place in Tarker's Mill, is a fictional town within the Stephen King universe. So it borders according to the IMDb research on this, it borders all of those other Stephen King's towns, such as like Chester's Mill and Derry and Castle Rock.
So Northeast. So,
yeah, it's supposed to be the Northeast. All of these people sound like they're from the South.
Yes.
Here's the thing, they don't even sound like they're from the Deep South. They sound like they're from, and Jeremy, you can relate because you're in Springfield, like that southern part of Illinois where everyone thinks they're from the South, but they're not.
Oh, yeah.
They're not like real sounding Southern accents. They're
We're talking the Carbondale area. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Shout out to our Carbondale listeners.
Yes. But,
like, and it's like Stephen King hates small town people.
Oh my God.
So I don't know who he hates more, like religious figures or small town people, because this small town is the biggest group of hicks and yokels.
Yes,
assembled on
that celluloid. Can like perfectly transition into probably my favorite performance of this entire movie, which is the girl's dad. I can't remember him at all. He's the kill in the barn.
Oh, but yes.
I wrote down the line, by the way, because
I think I know what line it is. I think I wrote down the same line, but what is it? Well,
let's see what we got here, because can
we try to say it at the same time?
Let me try to say it. Seeing Corey Haim in his like mechanized wheelchair riding with his daughter on a bike, this guy says, let's try this, Lou.
Oh, no. I think I have a separate line, so you go ahead.
Okay. Well, okay. He says, damn cripples always end up on welfare, need to execute them all and balance the budget. Oh my God.
You know, in 2019, that's not too far from a policy.
About to say that's coming out of the hill nowadays.
Anyway,
I think. But I just thought to myself, like, just to have that, because that was not an ad lib. All right, that's written.
No,
and like, that's why is it there?
No. Okay, so that same character has my favorite line, and this was the thought I was going to say, because it's the scene I figured you would remember as well, Jeremy, the scene where he's like sitting in his in his Lazy Boy watching pro wrestling.
Yep.
And he is so interactive, and he's watching, and he's like, "Oh, ow, oh, that hurts my parts. That hurts my parts."
Like, I'm just like, no, and this is a theme though in this movie. It's like there are not very good ensemble actors in this. You could, it's like if somebody like says, "Oh, my friend can act," and like then just cast them in it or something.
Come on in.
You know your movie is batshit when Gary Busey's not even in the top five of over the top performances.
No. Oh, that's so true.
He would be subtle. He's subtle compared to these people. This is like, he's like Philip Seymour Hoffman playing levels compared to some of these yokels.
And what's, yes, really people, we did just compare Philip Seymour Hoffman to Gary Busey.
What's really strange is when I was looking up stuff for this movie, is Gary Busey ad-libbed a majority of his lines. Yes. And he's the most sane person.
Yeah.
But that's big volume.
I mean, like, the very first thing we see Gary Busey do in this movie is like some spasmodic song about Yankees and cards and something like that that had to just come from the depths of his brain. And yet that's not as crazy as what this girl's dad is saying all the freaking time.
Right.
And I just don't get it.
And let's give, you know, some, just to give Gary Busey a little bit of credit, maybe for some of our younger listeners. For those who don't know, like, Gary Busey in the 70s and 80s was a very acclaimed character actor. He was nominated for Best Actor in 1978 for the Buddy Holly story. So he was like before, you know, the Gary Busey that we know today, which is much, you know, was way different. And there's a lot of issues that Gary Busey had. He had this massive motorcycle accident in 1988. He suffered some head injuries and he's never seemed to fully recovered from them. And there's might be some, you know, other issues at play with him. So yeah, like, he's, you know, in this movie, you can see, yeah, they probably trust him because he's the only legit credited actor aside from some of these character guys that they get. But again, it's another sign of where Stephen King is at in his life, where he's just be like, you know what? Busey's got this. let him ad lib, say whatever you want. Nope, Gary, you understand this character very well. You got it, bud.
You know, what I was just thinking of is, do you think the director told everyone, like, okay, I want you to be really menacing? So he's like, okay, I'll speak Southern.
It's just what they all thought of.
Well, and not to get back to Everett McGill, I feel bad for him in the sense, because what we said earlier, it's like, I don't know the werewolf's motivations, which is the only time I've ever uttered that sentence.
Right. The surrealness of that sentence alone.
Right. Like, he's like, sometimes, like, I think, because sometimes you see like werewolf movies where like the person is tortured because of what they're doing.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're seduced by the power of it. Then neither of those things happen here.
Or fornicator happening.
Fornicator, I'm going to climb up your...
I'm
up your wall and kill you.
I am going to use this newfound power as a moral crusade.
Right.
Yeah. Which makes all the sense in the world.
Is that why he went after the cripple?
The ironclad logic of, you know, suicide is a sin, so I killed her and her unborn child, but her soul is safe. Sure, man. Sure. But no, Lou, you're absolutely right, though, because like the rest of the small town like aspect of this, you know, this, that woman in question, the unwed mother to be, you know, she's talking with this guy that we overhear from the bushes, and literally, again, in like the deepest Southern accent this guy can muster, like, you know, saying like, "Oh, you got a bun, but that ain't mine. Is it not my oven?" or something like that. And then he walks away saying like, "Remember the good times, baby." I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, that is right out of some bad community theater.
Yes.
Like, that's what like the two local actors who've been done it forever, like, "Hey, we got this scene. We're gonna really show you something. Watch this."
No, but it's that. And then again, like, every scene in the bar is like some weird like statement about taxes or about like cop municipality law. Like, it's really weird why these scenes exist.
It's 1985. You gotta appease that Reagan base, man.
He just
won 49 states. You go where your bread's buttered in 1985, right?
I guess so, man,
that's a weird year because this is the same year as like Rocky IV and Rambo 2 and First Blood Part 2. So we're very, and Red Dawn is the year before. So we're very much, the politics of modern cinema in the mid 80s is pretty apparent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely.
There. But yet they're also being mocked at the same time, which I think I read in a couple of the reviews that somebody was saying that this is it was Roger Ebert who gave this movie 3 stars, described it as a satire of small town life. I mean, like, you are giving Mr. King way too much credit.
I'll give it this, okay? if that is the premise that we're playing in, okay, I will let my favorite reviewer of all time make that case, but I gotta say I'm pretty disappointed by that knowledge here.
I think he was just trying to make it sound like a good movie and give it some credit, but
you know what, this is something that I do as a reviewer too, though. It's just like I see that I'm watching something bad and my brain just naturally tries to rationalize, well, here's this part,
right? Like, maybe he's making a statement.
His statement is, I need rehab,
right? I think that was after Maximum Overdrive. That's the statement being made.
Because what we have not even gotten to, I mean, there's so much bonkers stuff going on that we have talked a half hour and we have not yet discussed that Corey Haim's character rides around in not a motorized wheelchair, but then that might make you think that it's like an electric chair that you've probably seen before. No, this is like a hybrid motorcycle wheelchair.
Yeah. I mean, they both run on gas.
Yeah. That then gets an upgrade in the second half of the movie that is in no way street legal.
Also, by the way, a very weird, like, 2-minute writing sequence in the middle of this horror film.
Stephen King is the only one that can give a quadriplegic kid means to make himself a complete quadriplegic. Completely.
Okay, so here's another question I have, though, because I don't want to make assumptions about the upper body strength of, paraplegic people, but am I to believe that this young man can literally scale the side of his house 2 stories at will?
Corey Haim, just using his
arms?
Who are you to doubt the upper body strength of a 13-year-old Corey Haim?
He works out, okay?
I'm just saying, it's like, because after the initial meeting with the werewolf, he rides back and literally he's just climbing in his window. And I'm like, No, like, there's no way.
Never mind.
That's right. I went there, everyone. I went there.
It's insane because, that's like, of all the things involved that character, that's maybe one of the most,
one of the most benign. Fine.
That's one of the smallest leaps you can make. Like, instead, he's like, you pointed out, right? He is riding around on this now, like, souped up wheelchair that can go like 50 miles an hour without a helmet. That's not safe.
And doing wheelies right away.
Lessons not using his legs. Like, I'd be like, okay, I see a problem here. I don't want to do anything that's going to cause me more pain.
Also, I mean, just the cleverness of calling both of them the silver bullet. I mean, foreshadowing there, Mr. King.
Oh, man. That's why he's the master.
Sometimes I hate this movie, guys. I get to a ridiculous scene, though?
Oh, please do.
Can we please talk about the hunting party?
That's my comedic scene.
I'm just... Okay, like, the literal Oscar-worthy dialogue about going tea in your pants or something like that, going lemonade in your pants, something like that, and then that guy going literally with going for the Oscar, saying something along the lines of "I'm not scared, let's go." Again, that is somebody's uncle that just was near the set that day. I mean, these people are terrible. But
can we pay you a couple dollars to die?
Yeah.
You might have to say a few things.
But I mean, like, seriously, the ultimate sin of this movie, in a movie full of sins, is the fact that, like, this is like a big, like, set piece of killing scene, and we just never deal with it.
No. Oh. This is the other thing. There's like, it's like junior high dance levels of fog.
Yeah.
So that you can, it's like somebody just went out and bought a shitload of dry ice so that they can disappear underneath it. So you don't have to see them die, because we only got 7 million.
Yeah.
And we got to buy, and we have to have two wheelchairs souped up. So that,
yeah, we've got to bash Terry O'Quinn's head in later. I mean, yeah. Come on, guys. We ain't got time for this. Yeah.
They give us one, the guy that slowly rises up and half his face is gone, and then he's right back down.
Yeah.
The rest is the werewolf uses a murder weapon. He uses a bat called the Peacemaker. It is that he takes it back home for incriminating evidence.
So the claws, the super strength, the massive jaws full of razor sharp teeth just weren't doing it for him that night.
No, you gotta kill people with a bat called the Peacemaker.
Yeah. But no, like, seriously, like, when you guys first saw this, like, after that whole dream sequence and stuff, did you think, like, did that happen? Like, was that just, like, part of the Reverend's dream?
Yeah. Here's the thing. It was all so vague to me. I didn't know who actually died. I was like, okay, so they're all just dead now. But I did know. I burst out laughing when the next scene was three coffins next to each other.
Because there was that whole party.
Yeah, because, like, they had two funerals already. And so part of me was like, it was that kind of shit. I thought it was kind of a really funny moment, a genuinely funny moment to be like, okay, now they're just like, well, the hell with it. These people are going to keep dying. We might as well, we're not going to keep having individual funerals. The church ladies can only do so many potlucks. We're going to just do
They're all related. They're brothers.
Right.
Okay. Same family.
Okay. So they're all together. And I thought, but no, it was hard to track because I couldn't tell necessarily what was going on, but I was probably also distracted by my favorite part of that whole sequence, which is the bear trap sight gag.
Yeah. Which serves no purpose.
No. Other than that, Stephen King thought that shit was hilarious.
He did think it was hilarious because it even turns into like that, what was that? Ah! Like, you know, like second snap on the ankle, which, by the way, could probably render you not using that foot again. But whatever.
No, it was like, that moment is something out of a sitcom, except it's in a horror movie, so it's going to be as graphic as possible. And it's at a moment where, like, we're supposed to be tense because we're like, oh, we're all, who knows where the werewolf is going to drive? I know, let's do some shtick real quick with this bear trap for really no good reason. And they know, but other than the fact that they thought, they had to have thought that was just funny.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, what? You're trying to, like, diffuse the tension that we're supposed to be feeling? Like, what? Why is it there again?
Who are you to judge the master of horror?
I was just going to say that, but, like, you know, this guy knows how to build suspense. Like, I honestly think that at that point in his writing, he stopped, snorted, and then kept writing. Because, I mean, this guy knows how to write suspense, and just for that scene, which should be so tense, is just so ridiculously awful.
Yes. No, so. there's hardly anything redeeming about it. Although there is a pretty nice throw up against the tree. But then, like, okay, so whoever ringleader man is of this lynch mob, basically, you know, or vigilantes, which they're for some reason very hesitant to say in that bar scene. Yeah, but, like, that guy, like, sees all this, presumably gets away, and then what, just spends his time under a hot towel at the barbershop the whole time? Like, where is the dealing with these deaths that just happened?
No, none at all. And, like, there's no processing of it. Like, the logic leaps in this movie just go very quickly, which brings up something that I wanted to bring up about Corey Haim's character. So Corey Haim is, like, the person who figures out what's going on. Here's the thing, though. He comes to the realization of werewolves very quickly.
Yeah.
Like, he just he never sees a werewolf. He has no evidence other than, like, mutilated corpses, I guess. And, like, it's like, I think after the first movie, he's like, he tells Gary Busey, "You think it could be a werewolf? Like, how the hell? What, are you just pulling that out of your ass, kid? Like, there's there's no reason to think that." So he goes from like serial kill, like, oh, some random person in the neighborhood could be killing. No, I'm pretty sure it's a werewolf. And then on the flip side, it takes Gary Busey a very long time to believe him for anything.
Yeah. Like,
Gary Busey's whole job in this movie is to make the wheelchair and then not believe anything else that this kid says.
Oh, and also, like, do it in one of the most derogatory ways of all times, because, like, there was a specific joke where he said, "I think your common sense got paralyzed with your legs," something along those lines. And I'm just like, wow. Like, I understand they have like that kind of a relationship, but Jesus, like.
Well, I mean, just to talk about the reveal, this is the uncle that not only gave him a souped up wheelchair, gave him fireworks to go off and have fun by himself.
Sure.
Which led to the reveal. So, but yeah, I mean, that seems something weird.
I mean, also, do any of us doubt the, like, you know, I guess the firework power of going into an eyeball, like that level of force?
I don't know.
I mean, because I'm assuming it was like the pointy nature of the firework and not the explosion that kind of did the eye.
Yeah.
So he shoots the firework into his eye, right?
Yeah, yes. That's what.
Which, like, is spectacular aim, by the way.
Yeah. Well, he takes out both eyes in this movie, so that kid, sign that kid up for, I don't know, some kind.
Which, I mean, you know, that's typical werewolf lore. Everyone knows you kill a werewolf, you need to kill a werewolf. Go for the eyes.
Go for the eyes,
I've
man.
I've said that. If I've said it once, I've said it a million times. When confronted with a werewolf, you go for the eyes.
Every single time I come across a werewolf.
Here's the thing I don't get. You know, you have a firework that has gunpowder in it and is going at a high rate of speed, mm-hmm. but no, it takes a bullet with almost the same high rate of speed. I just don't get it.
Well, it gives us our clever, this is how we deduce, this is how we deduce the werewolf, man. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we deduce he's going to be coming for me because werewolves hold grudges. That's a thing.
If they can wield a bat, they can wield a grudge. Okay.
Well, no, but that would be fine if it wasn't so ham-fistedly done, by the way, as well, because it's literally one line. It's literally one line that the sister says about, like, well, you know, maybe he's just always this way and it's just worse on the full moons. It's like, mm-hmm. Sure, why not?
The reveal's the best part. Like, she's sitting there and she's coming to collect cans, and the priest is gardening. And,
of course, like priests,
you know,
do.
He's talking to her, and you just see the left or the right side of his face, and then it pans over, and you're like, oh shit, it's him. It's like he just—it's giving us the most hammy way possible. But you know, you're just like, oh, I know who it is.
Oh yeah, which is again the thing we all wanted to know in this werewolf mystery movie was like, oh, thanks, why we didn't need it? We just need a werewolf going around killing people. That's all we need.
Yeah. I don't need intrigue. I don't need saving souls. No. I'm good.
Right.
Give me blood and guts.
Yeah. And then, yeah, to then say that there are, which again, shifting wildly from werewolf lore, and I'm like, again, I'm not necessarily married to the origin stories of mythical creatures, but this movie posits that there are degrees of wolfiness.
Yes. Yes.
That based on how much of the moon is showing will tell you how much of a wolf you're going to get.
Yeah, so, and also based on that Terry O'Quinn kill, you could just do it at will, like Bruce Banner in the Avengers. I mean, like...
Yeah, so apparently, like...
You wouldn't like me when the moon's full.
Right. That's the thing about me.
That should have been.
That's the thing about me. I'm always a wolf. So it's like, okay, so like it's a quarter moon, so it's like a quarter wolf. So does he have like the wolf strength, or do he just have a little bit of back hair?
I know. Do you only have like the front teeth? Like, are the back ones not quite in yet?
Then you get the half moon, and so maybe that's why, okay, he's still like half man, so he can like remember things, like he's kind of sentient.
Yeah.
And then the full moon, he's just full on werewolf. But even that doesn't track, because full moon werewolf in the finale knows exactly where to go because he knows exactly who he wants to kill.
Yeah.
So when it's a new moon, does he wake up with another eye? Like, is it a whole new werewolf? Like,
is this regenerative? Who knows? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, actually. Shouldn't he heal himself? Whatever. You know what? I just remembered. I don't care. I don't care, Stephen King.
I got to get to that new moon phase.
You didn't care, so I don't care, Stephen King. Okay. That's the rules.
Yeah. No, well, that's the thing. It's like he wanted so much to create his own werewolf lore, and it's just gobbledygook. Like none of it adds up at all. And it's like, again, it's him being like, I'm Stephen King. I'm gonna do whatever the hell I want at this point. Like, and he's just, and he's got nothing.
Yeah. We also have just a massive, very weird chase sequence with the car and the motorcycle.
Yes. You're right. Because then when the priest, who is also like, okay, so the priest during the day is aware that he's a werewolf at night.
Yes.
Which again, not necessarily.
Not a thing. Not a thing in werewolf lore.
Right. But isn't this one. So now, yeah, he wants to try to target Corey Haim. And instead of like, oh, I don't know, waiting till he's like a 300-pound man beast with razor sharp claws, decides I'm going to chase this kid in broad daylight.
Yeah, right there where everyone can witness it.
Everyone can see me.
Hey guys, yeah. Just out for a stroll.
Yep. Excuse me. Just going to try to run down this kid in a wheelchair. No.
Do you think there's any chance that he talked to that girl's dad before he killed him and said like, you know what? They are. We do got to balance the budget.
You're right.
That's my theory. It's like, yeah. Hey, I'm going to kill you, but you got some sound economic policies here, man. that whole thing is just nuts. Like,
right.
He was scared. He had to get his vehicle because he knew that he had more fireworks.
I guess that could be.
Yeah, and so then he like chases Corey Haim down on Corey Haim gets trapped in the bridge the Maitlands die on in Beetlejuice. And he's just sitting there, and I'm like, oh, don't do this, man. And like, I'm like, is this thing about, like, are we about to tease like a drowning?
Oh, Corey man.
Because doesn't he say that, like, you're about to have an accident, you're going to drown in the river or something like that?
And he gets out, and I don't, and the, what is it, the neighbor on the tractor?
Tractor, yeah.
He yells for him. Right? Yells for him, and okay. So small town folk ain't that bad. They'll rescue your kid from a collapsing bridge.
She just goes in, he's like, oh, it's scary in here, isn't it? Like, come on, man. Yeah. But like, that's like a full-blown, like, you know, he's trying to run him off the road. There's like near misses, like, you know.
And it takes up so much time.
Yes.
That's the other thing. It's like, there are so many things, like, I don't need him. Here's two things I know I don't need in my werewolf movies: mysteries and car chases.
Things you would never expect from a werewolf movie.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm sitting here, and this movie, but then this movie, it's very brisk. It's like a 94 minutes, and like at least 5 minutes of it is towards the end of the film. Like, I remember watching this, like, is this the climax of the movie? Because we only have like 10 minutes left.
No, that's exactly what I was thinking too, as I kept seeing how close we were getting to the end. I'm just like, it seems like there's a lot to wrap up here, but.
Yeah. No, and so the wrap up is like, this is the most, this is one of the easiest like confrontations of a killer in any horror movie ever, because they're just like, oh, we need to make a silver bullet. Let's make a silver bullet.
Hey, we have necklaces too, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, that happened to be silver. So they make a silver bullet. They sit at the house. They wait for him to show. It shows. They tussle for like 10, 15 seconds.
Yeah.
They shoot him. Movie's over. And they like 2 seconds later, the credits roll. It's like it's like it was a live broadcast, and they were like, hey guys, we gotta get this thing up. We gotta get this time. We gotta get this off the air. Go to the finish. And I'm like, no, it's a movie. You have all the time in the world.
Here's what happened. Stephen King's writing this down, like, oh, I have another idea for a movie. I'm gonna make trucks that kill people. Let's write the ending of this. Get started.
Yeah, exactly. Let's wrap this shit up. I got some more stuff.
The werewolf comes in, they shoot him the end. Oh man.
Gary Busey, I'm done.
Yeah, that's so crazy. Like, they do this whole time to set up this confrontation that takes like no time. They spend way more time on a car chase than they do like this werewolf actually like trying to attack, and like they want it. They keep everybody, all the three main characters alive, which it's like, okay, if you're gonna do that, like, you know, have them like pick off a couple of people along the way or something, do something. But like, it's like this anticlimactic. Nope. Yeah. I showed up. Boom. You're dead. Done.
No.
Like, well, the most dramatic thing about the is not can they fight the werewolf? It's, can Corey Haim reach the bullet?
Yeah.
Right.
That's the tension.
I can't get it.
I dropped the bullet in the vent.
And you know what? As a consequence of all of this, I'm going to go and say this. The werewolf seems the more sympathetic of the dual personality.
It is 3-on-1 at that point.
I mean, right? I'm sitting there and I was like, you just killed a dog, basically, I guess. But like, I get the sense that like the werewolf is like the unwilling participant in the priest's weird soul saving vendetta. Like that's the impression I'm getting here.
Yeah. So, okay. So is this like an awful priest to begin with? Was this guy like, because I mean, or did, does his like bullshit, like moral crusade happen, be just get intensified? Is he just like, so is this, okay, if I'm going to go with the Roger Ebert, is this like some satire of the moral majority of 1985? Because that was a big deal. Like, you know, was he just some like uptight moral crusader who then gained these powers and decided he'd kill off the like what he deemed the most immoral people in the town? If so, why are you targeting the kid in the wheelchair? He didn't do anything.
Yeah. Well, to quote a reviewer far smarter than me, if that's the point it's making, it does not make it well. I mean, that's not like, and again, like I get the sense that there's a message trying to be worked into the fabric of this horror story, but damn if I know any kind of coherence of what it is. I mean, if that is what it's trying to be, it is way too like in the weeds for it to even come through even a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really, I mean, the only way you can justify his actions is by saying that, oh, he shot me with a firework. I want revenge. I mean, that's really all I got.
Well, to be fair, though, he also is bullied by these kids as well. Mm-hmm. You know, threatening letters about killing yourself.
Oh, God, the letter. God, I forgot.
I mean, literally, we realize a guy's a werewolf. And our first note, our first step of action is to say, do a ransom note basically that says, hey, you should kill yourself. Not once, not twice, but three times.
We know who you are.
We know what you did. Why don't you kill yourself? I'm convinced.
That's how I know what you did last summer started.
I mean, the kids in this town are pretty awful. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
You got Corey Haim's little friend who like wants to, you know, just pester his sister and like throw her in the mud. So they, you know, everyone in this, you know what? I'm just going to say it. Everyone in this town deserved to die.
Yeah, you know what? Hey, I'm retroactively rooting for the wolf.
Not Corey Haim, okay? His Corey, friend ruined the hose, but he gave his sister money.
Yeah. Corey Haim and Gary Busey can ride off into the sunset together.
On his fireworks.
Yes.
Yeah, on the fireworks.
The sister character, too, is so weird because... I had to look that up because I was like, why is she, of all people, narrating this movie?
The narration is completely ridiculous and unfounded. It did not need it.
Well, we don't need the narration at all. Nothing. Anyway.
Well, and they
we didn't even need the sister.
No, and they didn't need it because the narration goes away for like 40 minutes. It comes back, and I'm like, oh shit, I forgot there's a narrator in this movie.
There's an outside observer here.
Yeah,
for some reason. No, but I honestly thought that it was going to be like they put a lot of stock in the first 10 minutes into like the brother sister relationship. And then that just goes literally nowhere.
No,
I mean, she played the role of, you know, stupid sidekick pretty good. Like, I just, some of the stuff that she just was there for to be like the revelation, I was like, why? Otherwise, you're just like, as a narration tool, like, you just not need it. Like, I was just very annoyed by her character.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because, she goes around to collect, like, bottles.
Cans. Yep,
cans or something. He easily could have done that, but I guess, you know, you don't want him to see you, I guess, but since you saw him before, but I don't know. That was awkward to me, but like, yeah, she disappears for way too long to be of like the amount of consequences she ends up being.
Right. Yeah. And the only thought that I had, and I won't I probably will never go read the source material. That I'm assuming that this is like a Shawshank Redemption thing where the original story was written from her perspective. And
not that I remember.
It's not? Okay, well, then I got nothing for you then.
But it does have pictures, so if you want to flip through, there are pictures.
Right, so it's like, okay, then maybe she was the narrator, but like, and it does the worst thing that you could do, which is give in a horror movie, which is give away that this one...
Somebody lives.
Yeah. Like, you already give away one of the survivors, which is one of the, like, the key traits of a horror movie, is who's going to make it out alive. And we're like, well, we know she lives because she's telling the damn story. So does Corey Haim bite the dust? And turns out, no one does. Just the poor werewolf.
Turns out werewolves are super easy to kill, guys.
Really, they are. They really are. Okay, before I get to some trivia, is there any other scenes or moments that you want to get to that we haven't covered yet? Jeremy, we'll start with you this time.
There's one scene in this whole movie that I think is actually legitimately good. It's actually a legitimately very well-acted scene.
You have my attention.
It's the scene with Brady's dad in the bar right before they go out on their hunting party. That guy, I want to say Kent Broadhurst, I think is his name. He's great in that scene. He plays up like that grieving father thing very, very well, and kind of speaks to like that whole, you know, revenge versus justice like thing. That was the one scene in the movie where I was just like, I actually stopped and I was like, oh, this guy's acting his ass off. That's really good. And then it's ruined 5 seconds later. But, you know, like that was like the one scene in the entire movie where I was there. And again, considering the rest of the movie, I was like, why is this here?
Fair enough. All right. How about you, Ryan?
For me, it's definitely the Terry O'Quinn death scene. Is it O'Quinn?
We have not talked enough about the Terry O'Quinn is John Locke from Lost, everyone.
Yes, he plays the sheriff.
And from every movie from 1985 to 1997.
Right. To me, his character was good. I wish there would have been more of him. He's always a great character actor. But his real good scene is his death scene, actually. Mm-hmm. The buildup that he just does, you feel him being a cop, you know, looking around and finding things. And then when he finds the bat, he turns around and sees the priest. That confrontation between him and the priest was actually pretty good for the moment. But then you have him turning into a werewolf in the cheesiest transformation scene possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Jeremy said, you have good things and then it's done.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And yeah, there's some enjoyment there because you see him. There's a couple of, you know, really there's some familiar character actors that it's fun to see. Obviously, it's fun to see Gary Busey and also Lawrence Tierney shows up as the bar owner, which is great. Like there's like little touches here and there. And it's like, you could see that there is some stuff there that could have, they could have worked a lot better than it does. I think we covered all of mine. So I do want to go to some fun stuff. So I mentioned at the beginning here that the director is Dan Ettias, but he's not the only director of this film. What apparently happened during the filming of this movie was that there were arguments about the werewolf itself. And so the producer, Dino De Laurentiis, the world, you know, famous, you know, iconic producer,
yes,
was unhappy with the werewolf that was used in the film. So he was both disappointed in the way that it looked and the way that the costume actor moved. And then ultimately there was a clash between him and the director and Stephen King. So this was Stephen King's version. By the way, I should mention, when they started shooting this movie, they did not have a proper werewolf suit.
Oh, sure.
So
why would you need that in your werewolf?
They had the hand for the swipes.
So they're basically like Jaws. They're like, well, we don't have the shark yet. They're like,
worked out for Spielberg.
Again, yeah, 100%. Somebody said that. I guarantee you.
Somebody said that.
10 like, years ago.
Worked fine for Jaws.
That was pasted on every trailer wall.
Yes. So eventually what had happened after seeing the design that was designed based off of what Stephen King wanted, the producer was unhappy. He demanded a change, which King and the original director, or actually, excuse me, the King Stephen King and the designer of the suit refused to change. So ultimately, pre-production falls behind schedule. They start shooting without the werewolf suit, but eventually, hey, we got to get the werewolf in suit. And eventually, so the original director, Don Coscarelli, who is famously known for the Beastmaster films and the Phantasm films, he just starts going ahead and filming, doing, hey, worked for Jaws, let's keep going. But so after they completed all the non-werewolf scenes, but they still didn't really know what would happen with the film because we've now made our werewolf movie with no werewolf. Eventually, the director, Coscarelli, resigns as director.
How formal of him.
Yes, and he's replaced by Attias. And so when pressured to either cancel the film or accept the design, De Laurentiis concedes and lets that werewolf suit be used. And so they ended up having a modern dance actor in the body of the werewolf so it can move in Heard a that. More I guess sinewy way. But they were
this keeps getting better, man.
So eventually they ended up having to put Everett McGill in the werewolf suit.
No.
And that is Everett McGill in the werewolf suit.
Oh, Everett. No.
Yep. Thank you, Lee, because I remember reading that when I was reading stuff about the movie. They're like, oh, yeah, it's a dancer. Mm-hmm. People didn't like it. They didn't like the fluidity.
Although, I'm not going to lie to you, I feel cheated. I feel cheated out of the modern dance werewolf movie.
Well, you know what? Hold on, brother, because in 2 months we're getting Cats, and that's going to be good enough. <It's the same laughs>
You were waiting for that segue, weren't you?
I will never not figure out a way to talk about Cats.
I think our full disclosure for that is just going to be Lou. He's going to do a live stream from the theater on Just
His Face. If I can.
Please go to the animal shelter in the cat room, please.
So there you go. That's apparently if the movie feels disjointed, that's kind of why, because they filmed all the non-werewolf stuff with one director, the werewolf stuff with another, and they didn't even know what they wanted the werewolf to do. So
because he didn't plie enough.
Which again, it speaks to, I think just Stephen King just really wanted to create his own new werewolf lore, because again, there are things that you think of when you think of a werewolf, but like poetic, graceful moves is not one of them. That's not a thing.
Well, if I remember the book correctly, the book is like a whole year. Like in this movie, we get maybe a month. I don't know.
It's like the last month of the summer, I think, is right. what the sister says.
But this movie takes place in the full moon 1 month, and it's literally 1 month. The whole story is 12 months, and each thing is different. And how there's always a murder once a month, and it's grisly and all that stuff, and it's the buildup. Where this one, you're like, oh, yep, here you go.
Yeah, because that was the other thing, though. It's like, well, the townspeople are not freaked out enough by many grisly murders in like a day's amount of time. They should all be leaving.
Nobody thinks to just pack up and get out.
Yeah, everybody's still just opening their door like, oh, hello. Would you like some cans? No, but even other than that, like Lou, they tried to do that. They tried to set it up because they have a line where they're like, oh, you know, he explored so much werewolf mythology and it varied, but there was always one thing that was true, the silver. And it's like, God, just like take your own advice, man. Just go for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the last piece of trivia that I'll leave you with is that it could, as bonkers as this movie is, it could have even been more so. Because in early drafts of the film's script, including the press book release, meaning close to, we were very close to shooting. The werewolf had lines. The werewolf spoke.
So please tell me one of them was batter up.
Oh, Ryan, you just signed a 5-picture deal, my man.
Yeah, didn't have to do any cocaine either.
Oh my yeah. God. So you mean we could have gotten not only a modern dancing werewolf, we could have had the Southern drawl as well?
Mm-hmm. A talking werewolf. We could have had talking werewolves.
It's like Rhett Butler turned into a werewolf, man.
The possibilities of like spewing like Bible verses as he's killing mm-hmm. people. I mean, things just could have been.
Yeah, we was like quoting Ezekiel or something, like stalking people.
We just. Yeah. So, yeah. And so unfortunately we had to wait 20 years to get hairy, redneck, morally crusading assholes on Duck Dynasty. So, there you go. But we finally got them.
Oh man.
Yay us.
Everything is worth it, people. Everything is worth it. Right. And now if that's not in cats, I'm going to be very disappointed.
If there's not a cat with a very thick Southern accent for no reason.
What the hell are we doing here?
All right. So let's take this to the guilt meter.
Oof.
On a scale of 1 to 5 shame spirals, 1 being you either love this movie, you love this movie, you will show this at your Halloween party, you want people to see it, you'll play it every time there's a full moon. 5 meaning you either straight up don't like this movie, or if you do like this movie, you're not going to tell anybody about it, you couldn't recommend it to anybody, you just watch it by yourself in the dark. Where does Silver Bullet fall for you? Ryan, you are the Stephen King aficionado here. I'll let you start.
I have to go with the 2. I'm sorry. The movie is bonkers, and it's meant to be bonkers. But it's still got some Stephen Kingy to it in his attempt. In the annals of werewolf movies, this is definitely up there. People look at this movie and they're like, okay, this one's good because of the fact that it does deal with a mystery type of feel, and some of the effects are cool. Along with the violence. I just wish we would have had more with it, but definitely a 2 just because of, you know, it's from Stephen King. It's from his mind. It's from, you know, 80s Stephen King. It's there.
All right. Jeremy, how about you?
So if I'm remembering right, like if I like hate this movie's existence and curse it abysmally, it's a 5.
Correct.
I'm going to go with a 4. No, here's the thing, like, right, there are like times when this kind of a movie can be very fun to watch. You know, you can get people and you can basically MST3K it, right? Yep. And you can do that. I was doing it by myself and I had a ball. But the thing about it is, though, is like, I just think a movie kind of has to have some self-awareness as well for that to be true sometimes. And I feel like this movie is too disjointed to consistently do that, you know? Like, cause there is that sequence of like Brady's father, like desperately telling about how grief stricken he is. And I'm like, well, I can't make fun of that. And you know, like there's all these uncomfortable paraplegic jokes that I can't make fun of that because they're doing a good job on their own. So I don't know, man. Like I think there's better werewolf stories. So I'm giving it a 4.
Oh man. You just brought up a moment that I forgot, which is the dad, his screaming / crying moment.
Yeah.
It is so unsettling. Like, I think he thought that was his Oscar moment. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Oh, no. He picked out his tux that day.
Easy, bro. Okay. No. I'm going to go 1.5 here.
Oh.
I had so much fun. If this is all of what's mid-80s Stephen King is, sign me up, man.
Yep.
Because this movie, I had like I almost thought I could show this because yes, it's violent, but it's so cheaply made. Like, I don't think anybody could be like grossed out by this violence because it looks so bad. Like it looks like a B movie, but it's like attempting to be more. And that's like a sweet spot for me. Like there's hubris here, which I'm always a fan of, and just some nonsensical decisions that are great. And it is so cheesy to me. I wouldn't recommend it to everyone. I'm certainly not recommending it for somebody who wants like a good Halloween scare. This is not that. This is Halloween party, have some beers, like laugh
Let's watch a stupid movie.
Let's watch a stupid movie. And so for that, like, if you are a horror fan and you don't take your horror too seriously, you need to see this movie because it's so much, because it's a lot of fun. It's actually right now only, it's $4.99 on iTunes. So,
I mean,
you could snag that up and own it, and watch it whenever you like.
Make it your tradition, people.
Yeah. So no, I want to thank Justin for recommending it because I didn't realize that there was a big motorized wheelchair hole in my heart until this movie came along. And so it is now full. And so thank you to Justin for that recommendation. And I want to thank you guys for joining us. And if you want to hear us talk about some trash movie that you love, let us know. Send us, all you have to do is go to the Guilty Pleasures feed on iTunes, give us a review, preferably 5 stars. I don't know if we'll do a movie, but give us 1 star. Just to say, but if you give us a 5-star review, and in the review you request a movie, we're gonna do it. We've done them all. We're caught up now. So the floor is yours. Let us know what you want us to do. And in the meantime, stay tuned for everything else we got coming up on Guilty Pleasures. November is gonna be a very fun month. We are gonna start the month, I believe, probably about mid month, right around the release of the rebooted Charlie's Angels franchise that's gonna come out. Oof. We're gonna be talking Charlie's Angels Full Throttle.
Oh.
The Disneyland foodies are coming back for that. I'm excited to have them back. And then the movie that I'm particularly excited about, I've been teasing it all year. I think we're finally going to get to do it. We're going to close out November with Tango and Cash.
Yes.
So two outstanding movies. So I'm very excited about that. Ryan, what do you got going on with the Front Row Network? Tell us what's up.
Next month, we're celebrating a beloved children's classic. We've got The Page Master with Macaulay Culkin, and What It Is to Be a Kid in a Library.
All right. And Jeremy, what else have we got going on with the Front Row?
Yeah, so obviously MonsterCast has been so awesome. You've got one more MonsterCast spotlight tomorrow night, which is going to be Halloween night, yes, of course. And it is going to be on Drew Goddard's Cabin in the Woods. And Sarah and I recorded that one, and it is a massive dive into all of the Easter eggs in that movie. And it's fantastic. But next month you're going to be getting some Full Disclosures, like Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. You're going to be getting, what I'm pretty excited about, some reports from and interviews that we did at Wizard World Comic Con Chicago and at the Ace Comic Con up in Chicago that we got to go to. And that's going to be great. And then Brandon Davis and I are actually coming back with 100 Best. We're giving you numbers 80 through 71 on our top 100 films of all time. And of course, as always, Are You Afraid of the Podcast is still going. We're going to go to the one on our next episode, the episode, the story that inspired M. Night Shyamalan to write The Sixth Sense. So stay tuned for that.
All right. Yeah. And the way you can do all of that is by staying up to us on our social media. Follow us on Facebook, The Front Row Network. Follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with the Z. Go to our website, frnpod.com. And of course, our main feed stuff you can always find on nprillinois.org. The Guilty Pleasures feed has its own separate feed. So if you want both Charlie's Angels Full Throttle and Tango and Cash, you're going to have to go to the Guilty Pleasures individual feed. You're not going to want to miss either one of those.
Nope.
But yeah, keep up to date with everything that we've got going on. We're getting into winter movie season, all sorts of fun stuff. Award season's just around the corner. Tons of stuff coming up. And you can follow me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hare. Tell me what you thought about Silver Bullet. Tell me what you want to see on Guilty Pleasures. Make sure you join us if you're in the Springfield area on November 8th, Anvil and Forge for the Front Row's 500th episode extravaganza. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a great time. So I hope you're there to join us and join us for everything else that we're doing for the next month. So until next time, for the Front Row Network, I'm Lou Hare.
I'm Jeremy Gechner.
I'm Ryan Lutens.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org.